work on looking at LED lighting and LED efficiency. And what he is going to talk about today is how efficiently can we actually convert photons into food, which is a big topic in controlled environment agriculture. So Bruce is going to enlighten us, I'm sure. No pressure.
Thanks, Mark. I wish I could move this right over there so I can be with my slides, but I tried it yesterday. It's not easy to do, so I had to stand here. I'm going to do some back-of-the-envelope calculations on inputs and outputs to these systems. And I've divided this up into four little chapters in my talk. Ray just alluded to grams of biomass per mole of photons, and interestingly enough, the numbers in his talk that were the highest came from my lab, and most of them, and we now know those were overestimates based on guardrail effects of canopies. So I'm going to take a little more rigorous look at how many photons does it take to make food, and this is regardless of where the food is grown, just that conversion efficiency. So you can see what's going into this thing is photosynthetic photons, by the way. They're all, some are bigger than others because they got higher energies, but a lot of photosynthetic photons going into this funnel. So our unit of production is 1 gram. And this is 1 gram of dry biomass. So in a minute I'll show you what happens in that funnel, but if we calculate how many photons it takes to make 1 gram, 6.02 to the 10 to the 23rd. A colleague I showed this to said, wow, you can get that down to, wow, that kind of number. And I realized they were somebody that hadn't had beginning chemistry and they didn't realize that number. So they didn't know whose phone number that was. So this is one mole that can produce 1 gram. So this is a simple and profound ratio, a mole of photons and a gram of dry biomass. And I love things that are one-to-one ratios. You can remember these things. Now, that little blob right there is a gram of dry biomass. It's not yet yield. So when we go to yield, because of the harvest index issues, now we're talking about 1 to 1/2. These are pretty round numbers. That happens to be some wheat seeds. And that's about 1/4 teaspoon of wheat seeds. About 30 seeds is 1/2 gram. So with this, I want to pay a bit of tribute to this guy, who both Ray Weather and I worked with extensively. And this was some of the papers that in my early career were with him. If you're older than about 40 years old, you would have known him because of this textbook. It went through 5 editions. Now Taiz and Zeiger is a big plant physiology textbook, but most people in this room used 1 of the 5 editions of this book for plant physiology, and it was fun to work with him. It was a bunch of years. Ray and I still remember that. He just celebrated, if you do the math, his 89th birthday about a week ago. And he lives in Logan, and I see him occasionally. I go grocery shopping. He's in there signing books for people. not plant physiology textbooks, by the way. All right. We're going to work through the 4 critical steps of how we get from photons to food. And these are particularly important to plant scientists and horticultural scientists. You're keenly aware of each of these 4 steps. How high can they get? And as Mark mentioned, this has been a huge part of my career, is analyzing this and modeling it for food production systems. So the first one, they have to get absorbed by the plant canopy. Plant canopies are not black bodies. Some bounce off. Some are transmitted. We can get up to 90% absorption in a canopy that's closed, where you can't see the ground, the 90% trapped photons. That's step one. It's not 100%, but it's close. The second thing is quantum yield, which is moles of carbon fixed per mole of photons absorbed. Step one, absorbed them. Quantum yield is this exact ratio. The theoretical maximum is somewhere around 0.8, and we can get close to that in plant canopies. The trouble is, as you get higher light, this number gets smaller, but I'm calculating maximums, so we're looking at 0.07, and that number, by the way, came from a paper that I co-authored with Jonathan France called Exploring the Limits of Crop Productivity of Lettuce. That was the highest number we got with lettuce. It was, and this is, of course, with CO2 enrichment to high levels to get to that. So we're going to take four numbers and multiply them by each other in this thing. Carbon use efficiency and respiration. Some of that energy fixed in the day is used to make cellulose, proteins. We typically say this is about 60% efficient, but you can do a little bit better than that in some cases. So I'm putting this number at 65% efficient. And by the way, that came from a very fine paper by Mark Van Eersel. I think it's one of your finest papers ever, Mark.
So.
Mark calculated in that paper the theoretical upper limit of this might be 0.68, but we're putting this at 0.65. These are high numbers to get, so we're working toward that 1 gram of biomass. Now we finally, the fourth and final one is harvest index. In lettuce, you can get up to about 0.85. A little bit of roots, a little bit of inedible stem base, 85% harvest index. So we multiply those four numbers together, and we're at 0.035 moles of carbon fixed per moles of photons. All these numbers have been studied at great length, but we're not yet at biomass. So to get biomass, we need to have the carbon fraction of the plant, because the plant's not pure carbon, and that's, lettuce can be about up to 42% carbon. And with that, you do this little math, 28.6 grams of biomass per mole of carbon times that 0.035, and boom, one. A one-to-one ratio of photons in, grams of dry biomass out. This, so remember this number now for some of the back of the envelope calculations we're going to go through, to the implications of that for growing food. Key point, that is only for lettuce. If we take a crop like tomatoes and put a little bit more realistic numbers in here, and I won't go through all these numbers, but you can see they're just slightly less. To be a little more realistic, a half a gram of dry weight per mole. So we're in this range of a half a gram to a gram of dry weight per mole of photons. Now let's take that number and apply it to systems and inputs and outputs. So I'm calling this slide theoretical economics. My colleagues would be, theoretical economics is a discipline. It deals with human behavior and choices, and this probably should be called back of the envelope economics, but I kept theoretical on here. So we multiply a couple numbers together that determine an upper limit on the cost to produce dry biomass. 10 cents a kilowatt hour multiplied by the efficiency of our best electric lights. That second number right there, 1 kilowatt hour per 6.12 moles of photons, comes from this paper right here with one of my graduate students, Economic Analysis of Greenhouse Lighting. We tested a lot of lights, and there are several lights, both high pressure sodium and LEDs, tied for first place at 1 kilowatt hour per 6.12 moles of photons. So you multiply those two numbers together, and a mole of photons costs 1.6 cents. So we say that number's going down. Price of electricity has been pretty stable. At some point, we hope we'll have another breakthrough with LEDs like we did with blue LEDs, and then they'll get more efficient. But this conversion efficiency of LEDs has been stable now for several years. We haven't had big breakthroughs. The cost is coming down, but we haven't had breakthroughs in the efficiency yet. 1.6 cents per mole. Now we take that times a half a gram dry weight per mole. A kilogram of dry weight costs $32 in electricity. This is a kilogram of dry weight. Now we can play around with that number. If you could get your electricity for a nickel a kilowatt hour, and if you can get off-peak electricity in the right places, now this would be $16 per kilogram dry weight. Let's take 10 cents as a good average. Some places pay a lot more than that, but 10 cents is a good average electric cost. Now let's look at what it costs to grow wheat, what the value of wheat is compared to this. A bushel of wheat, and this is organic high-value wheat. This $9 a bushel is a very high price for wheat. It's not average wheat, it's high-end wheat. You do the math on what a bushel weighs, 60 pounds. Wheat is worth 33 cents a kilogram. So look at those numbers. The electric bill is 100 times higher than the value of the wheat. So we are not going to grow wheat with electric mites. It's not possible. Something would need to cost $900 a bushel to pay the electric bill to grow it. So this same story is the case with all of our agronomic crops that are sold dry. Their value is low, and the cost of the electricity is high. So just this number right here shows that we are not going to feed the world with electric light. We're going to use sunlight to grow those crops. And I could have put all the crops in here, but they're real similar to wheat. But now let's look at tomatoes. You can go to the store and get high-end organic tomatoes, gourmet tomatoes, for about $4 a pound. And since there's 454 grams in a pound, I round the number to make the math easier. Tomatoes are worth about $10 a kilogram, but note this is fresh weight. Tomatoes are 90% water, so we get 90% of the weight for free with tomatoes. Boom! Tomatoes are worth $100 a kilogram. Now that $32 per kilogram of dry weight doesn't look so bad, because the value of the product exceeds the electric bill. This gets even better with lettuce, because lettuce is 95% water, so that tiny bit of dry weight that we work so hard to get with photosynthesis gets amplified by all the water, $200 a kilogram. So you can see the issues here. If we can sell things fresh that are hydrated with a lot of water, they're worth a lot. So this is the only slide I have on economics, but the point is real clear. For agronomic crops, we're going to grow them outside. For high-value commodities, they have the potential to be grown inside. So this is sort of the end right here of chapter one of my talk. The next little section is environmental effects of indoor farming or indoor growing. And I want to look at, if you go to the internet, it's for more than a few minutes, you see lots of claims made by multiple manufacturers about the environmental effects. This is one that's on GreenSense Farms' website. GreenSense Farms uses 0.1% of the water, land, and fertilizer of field farming. 0.1%. zero carbon food, this is in London, lower energy consumption than glasshouse growing, 70% less water used. Farming greatly reduces our carbon footprint and minimizes the use of fresh water. So this isn't economics. This is now just analyzing these statements made by these companies. And this is a new, in the last year, this has been, for me personally, this has been a new branch of my career looking at carbon footprints of the food system. And it's been really exciting to look at this. Uses life cycle analysis. Now, I know lots of people have heard of this, but this is looking at all of the inputs to system, in this case, a food system, from the very first inputs all the way. It's called cradle to grave. So here's an analysis for 1 kilogram of hard cheese. I think it could be almost any kind of cheese. But it includes the production inputs to the cow, the transport to the factory, the packaging, we talked about that. Each of those in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with those. So it goes through this thing. The bottom is significant. So the greenhouse gas emissions for 1 kilogram are about 8.8 kilograms of CO2 equivalents. 8.8, so the number's roughly 10 CO2 equivalents for 1 kilogram of food. And much of our food system is this way, the big environmental impacts in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Similar to driving a car 20 miles is a reference point. Now look at the last part. And the people in this room might know enough to be suspicious. Or it's equal to leaving an incandescent 100-watt light bulb on for 1 hour. Wait a minute. 1 hour for a 100-watt bulb? That's completely wrong. I quickly did the math, and it's a 1,000-watt bulb for 16 hours. So that part is wrong in this. But remember that 8.8 kilograms for cheese. Now, this is an animal product, cheese, so that has a much bigger impact than straight vegetable production. This can also be used for buildings. It's used for everything. The inputs to buildings, life cycle analysis, is multiple programs with increasing level of sophistication to do life cycle analysis that does economic, it's not so much economic analysis, it's energy inputs and CO2 equivalents. So the first thing we come to is food miles. And the perception has been transport is a major, major cost in our food system. Eat local, buy local. It's going to save the planet. In 2008, these two guys, who both happened to be at Carnegie Mellon, the institute from our next speaker, wrote this paper, Food Miles and the Climate Impact of Food Choices. It's a classic paper, highly cited, 567 citations. In this paper, and they did extensive life cycle analysis, greenhouse gas emissions are responsible for only 4% of our food system. The transport is not a big cost in terms of environmental impact of our food system. Contrary to what many people believe, it is not a big cost. Many people have gone on to repeat this, but that's a key point here. But if you read this paper carefully, that's an average number for all of our food. They also ran transport costs for fresh foods, which again, now we're shipping a lot of water, and we get a very different number. Fresh fruits and vegetables are 11% of our energy cost, still a small number, but that's for 1,000 kilometers. So of course I immediately did the math. From Los Angeles to New York City is 4,500 kilometers. Now we're at half, 49% of the cost of getting fresh produce from California to New York is transportation. So you got to take this stuff in context. The average for our food system might be low, but when we look at horticultural crops, it's a much bigger cost for transport, leading to local production, controlled environment production in local places. So one other key slide in here to put this in context, this is another data from their paper. Our food system is responsible for 8.1 tons of CO2 emissions per year. Transport's a small part of that. Cars, 4.4. So the food we eat is responsible for roughly a double CO2 emissions than the cars we drive. I gave a TED talk last year called Turning Water into Food, and that's one of the statements I made, that kinds of food we eat have a bigger environmental impact than the cars we drive. And it's very true, and it's very counterintuitive, but as agricultural scientists, I think it's our responsibility to be aware of this and look at ways we can make food production systems more efficient. So one little point about this, CO2e, lots of people know that, but not everybody. The E doesn't stand for emissions, it stands for equivalents. So what's a CO2 equivalent? It's a combined result of CO2 and the two other big gases that have major impacts on the global warming, methane and nitrous oxide. We already talked about nitrous oxide radiated. Methane's 30 times more powerful. Nitrous oxide is 300 times more powerful. So trace amounts of denitrification from our agricultural systems are huge impact. Methane and nitrous oxide are getting tremendous interest now because animal agriculture produces a lot of both of those gases, making animal agriculture making animal agriculture a big factor in this. Let's see, emissions. So yep, it's called global warming potential. All right, this is a key slide, and I'm going to work through this. This is CO2 equivalents per kilogram of tomatoes produced in four ways. The first one is produced in California, Arizona, Florida, Mexico, and shipped to some northern location. The second one's produced in a hoop house. Third one is a heated greenhouse. And then finally, this maximum potential for indoor farming, using that 1 gram per mole of photons, we can calculate the inputs and outputs from that. This largely comes, some of this comes from this paper at the bottom, out of Cornell, David DeVilliers, and several other authors. One of them's Lou Albright, and I've known Lou forever, and here's his picture standing in a greenhouse, and I've communicated a lot with him on calculating these CO2 equivalents. So let's first look at the CO2 production for grown in California and shipped to, in this case, New York. Remember 50% shipping costs? There it is. The field production's 0.3. The transport is also 0.3. So the sum of this is 0.6. Now remember that hard cheese a minute ago? That was 8.8 kilograms of CO2 equivalents per kilogram of hard cheese. So this, but the hard cheese doesn't have very much water, and these tomatoes are fresh weight, but you start to get a sense of these numbers. So now let's look at a hoop house. I must need to keep my fingers away from this. Now let's look at a hoop house. Transportation, virtually zero because it's local production. The production in a hoop house is about the same. CO2 equivalents per kilogram, about the same. So if this ended here, hoop house is better, but what do you do? This hoop house was unheated. So this is 8 months of production, not 12 months. What do you do in the 4 months of the year? Do you just not eat tomatoes? You don't have that option. You have to ship them in. So now you take a heated greenhouse. Just the heating for that greenhouse is 2 kilograms of CO2 per kilogram of tomatoes. The production, even though the yield is higher, it's more intense production. So that's a 0.5 is a little higher than 0.3. So now we look at indoor farming. The electric bill alone is $9 to grow these tomatoes. So this is a big electric bill for growing the tomatoes. It certainly favors making direct use of sunlight whenever possible to grow the tomatoes in terms of the carbon footprint. This is not the economics, this is the carbon footprint. The production, I put 2 to 4. I'm in the process of analyzing that. Just as Nate mentioned, just the fans alone to keep the air moving through those things is a big part of the cost. Air is compressible. It's not like water. It's much harder to move air than it is to move water. But the electric bill we can zero in on quite well because we know the carbon costs of electricity and the amount of food we can grow from it. So let's now take a look at lettuce. Now remember, lettuce is more favorable in our economics because of more water. This comes from a paper out of Michigan State, and this is analysis. There's the papers at the bottom. Mike Hamm is the professor there. He has a chair in sustainable agriculture at Michigan State, and I worked with him on developing this analysis for lettuce. Now let's take the same thing. Transport cost for lettuce go way up. Wow, remember tomatoes was 50% transport? This is way more. Lettuce has to be shipped in a refrigerated truck. That's way more expensive, and it's a lot of water. So the transport costs for lettuce are much higher, so this favors local production. Hoop house? Well, for the months a year you can use the hoop house, or local production is much better. Heated greenhouse, the heating costs are a little less because it's cooler temperature for lettuce, shorter life cycle. Production costs are roughly similar so far. Now indoor farming, the electric cost is a lot less because lettuce is more water. It's primarily because it's more water than tomatoes. So it's still a bigger carbon footprint, but it's much more favorable than the tomato carbon footprint. This is for whole heads of lettuce. Now we've heard from speakers doing this, baby lettuce, microgreens, stuff grown for shorter time periods, those make the environmental costs less because they're grown for short periods of time. And you get almost to a point where you just it's a little past sprouts. There's photosynthesis, but you're using the energy of the seed to grow it. So these analyses are for whole heads of lettuce, not for baby lettuce greens, because those would be more favorable. But it does give you a sense of the environmental impact of the electricity in these systems. So people say, well, we'll just use renewable energy. We just use solar panels, and now the carbon footprint's zero. And, of course, if you did this next to the Hoover Dam, your carbon footprint's zero, too, taking someone's electricity to grow it. But places that have hydroelectric power have a really small carbon footprint. That turns out places like Washington State's one of the lowest carbon footprints for electricity in the nation, mostly because of hydroelectric. I'd like to run this through now from sunlight to moles of photons using direct use of sunlight and using solar panels and electric lights. And this is a pretty simple analysis, and I hope it's somewhat memorable. If you make direct use of sunlight, the design goal for modern greenhouses is 70% transmission. So it's pretty simple. We get 1,400 micromoles per meter squared per second at the canopy. We could scale this up and call it moles per day. It'd be the same ratio. The equivalent at solar noon, we get 2,000 micromoles of photons. We also get 1,000 watts per meter squared of total, which is what drives solar photovoltaics. So those are the exact same numbers, just different units. The installed efficiency of solar photovoltaics at best is 15%. Panels can be 16%, 17%, but you get 20, 30% losses in the conversions to the grid. So we get 1,000 coming in, we get 150 watts of electricity coming out. Now our best lights, high pressure sodium and LEDs, 1.74 micromoles per joule. This is coming from that paper we published last year, 88 delivered to the plant canopy if we take the sun, convert it to electricity, and then convert it back to light. So the thermodynamics don't favor electric lights in this analysis unless you can make the economics pay, unless you can do a lot more with those photons by optimizing the environment. So you can see that 1400 is many times higher than the 88, and I ran an analysis of how many acres of solar panels would it take to get the equivalent light on 1 acre, and it's 16 acres of solar panels to light up 1 acre at the same light intensity as you would get outside in the field. This is an actual picture off the internet. I can't believe they took prime agricultural land and put solar panels on it, but they did in this particular application. So, again, we're not going to grow our staple food crops under electric lights. The energetics aren't favorable, unless we get nuclear power and energy is abundant and free. But if we ever got that, there are all kinds of things that change. So back to the gases for a second. The CO2 footprint for our electric is getting better in the United States, and it's primarily getting better because we're using more natural gas. You can hardly pick up the newspaper and read about shifts in this. Coal-fired plants are being phased out. Coal is a bad player for this, a lot of CO2 footprints. If we can use natural gas, it's about 30 to 40% more smaller CO2 footprint, but natural gas is methane. If you have 3% leakage of methane as you're extracting the natural gas, it cancels out the advantage. They're about equal because it's 30 times more potent. The fracking companies getting natural gas say, we've tested this over and over, we're less than 1% leakage as we extract the natural gas. There are groups that have been doing meteorological studies near these with looking at the ambient methane levels. They have been publishing numbers of 10% leakage. This has just recently happened. If it's 10% leakage, that natural gas is making our global warming a lot worse. And it's real controversial. It's a red hot topic right now. How much leakage of methane is there when they're getting the gas out of the ground? I think we're going to see a lot more studies on this to hopefully be able to extract it very efficiently. Water use. Remember the claims of massive reduction in water use. Here's the perception of the public about water used in agriculture. We devote 70% of our water to agriculture as a nation, and really much of the world, 70%. So that means the perception of the public is, man, those guys are just dumping it all over the place. They can't be using that efficiently if it's 70%. Here's a diagram, massive leaching, massive evaporation, hardly anything going through the crop. The reality is more like this, particularly for high-value crops. Subsurface drip irrigation, even just drip irrigation, there's minimal leaching, minimal evaporation from the surface. Most of the water is going through the crop. Now, that's not to say there's a lot of waste in many agronomic crops, but in high-value crops, the story looks a lot more like this. So Ray alluded to condensing the water and recycling it, and if you can recycle it by condensing the way NASA has done in the chamber, terrific. But let's look at the energy costs of that. I looked up the cost to desalinize ocean water, because we have plenty of water. It's just saline. There's tons of saline aquifers all over the country just can't use them. It's high. You do the math. You don't have to follow all this math. 0.45 kilograms of CO2 per kilogram of dry mass of food produced. Now, remember that ratio we were talking about? 10 kilograms of CO2 to produce 1 kilogram of hard cheese, and some of those other numbers were roughly 1-to-1. Desalinization is expensive, but it's not that expensive. And that's a plant in Sydney, Australia, desalinizing water big time for use there. This number is getting better. It's cheaper to desalinize ocean water than to condense water vapor out of the air. That's why we don't have big air conditioners in the desert to dehumidify the air and produce condensed water out of the air. We desalinize. It's cheaper. So in terms of economics of saving water, well, we can use our electricity and use saline water to water the plants in the field. Nitrogen. Here's the perception. And anybody that's had soil science or soil fertility knows these. We get some ammonia volatilization, some nitrous oxide volatilization, some runoff, some leaching. Wow, this is really bad, and a little bit in the plant and agriculture is just poisoning the whole environment in nitrogen. The reality for high-value crops, again, it looks like this. We can get in high-value crops, we can get 90% nitrogen recovery in the plant tissue. So there's big differences in the perception of the public and the reality of people looking at this. Now, of course, in indoor production, you can get very high recovery in the plant tissue too. Maybe the number's approaching 100%, but you got to compare them to high-value crops in the field, which are already pretty efficient. Phosphorus. We're running out of phosphorus. It's a finite reserve. Here's the world phosphorus reserves. Surprisingly, Morocco is loaded with phosphorus, and so is China, but the United States isn't doing bad, but this is it. And we estimate, the analysts estimate, we got about 70 to 100 years left of phosphorus on the planet, and that's why we're working at recycling it from lots of sources now. But once again, in a high-value crop, now phosphorus, we put a lot more on the field. The recovery of phosphorus from typical agriculture might be 20 or 30% because it precipitates in the ground and it's just lost. But if we use slow-release phosphorus in high-value crops, now the recovery can be 60%. So once again, when people make comparisons, they should make them to high-input crops in the field because they're comparing them to high-input crops in a controlled environment. Final chapters here. Beware the magic bullet. And I want to show you two stories from direct personal use where I've been personally mistaken about stuff. And the very first one, story number one, is with NASA. As Ray pointed out, we spent years growing wheat for space, and we were all excited, and we made graphs about how we can live on the moon and Mars because we're going to grow our own wheat, until we got to reality and ran the numbers and realized that it's cheaper to grow the wheat on the ground and fly it to the moon than to grow it up there. But boy, we spent a lot of time figuring out how to grow it. And that's all good work, and some days somebody will use it, but the transport costs to the moon were cheaper than growing it up there. It's a lot of parallels to the ground. And so now that's why we're doing lettuce and fresh vegetables for lunar transport. We're not doing wheat anymore. How many millions do you think we spent in taxpayer money doing this when we realized we should be focusing on fresh greens up there? The second one is another big project I was involved in for just the last 10 years, algae. Biodiesel from algae. What a terrific topic. Don't have to have petroleum. Algae make high lipids, and you can extract the lipid and directly make biodiesel. So we had high input, flat plate bioreactors, low input raceways. This was a DOE-funded project. We did a lot of work on this. There's the algae safflower. Oil yields. Look at the microalgae down there. This is a paper by this guy, Chisty, 2007. massive oil yields per acre. This is extrapolated, right, from lab data now up to hectares. 1 to 2% of our land area in the United States, we could grow 50% of the biodiesel for the country. Who wouldn't want to believe this number? All politicians keep funding that research. Wow, this is just terrific stuff. This paper is cited over 2,000 times. We now know that these extrapolations are, well, thermodynamically impossible. The actual oil yields are less than a tenth of these numbers because of careful research. But we sure put a lot of money into biodiesel from algae. I can tell you, all of our analyses say if diesel gets to $10 a gallon, this will be cheaper. But it's so easy to drill a hole and pump it out of the ground that this is not cheaper, and it's not going to be cheaper because it's a lot of work to fix the algae from photosynthesis. So these are two stories that cases where I got swept up with the magic bullet and enthusiasm, and we realized wasn't as good as we thought. Final little tiny chapter, feeding the world. What about the case that we can't feed the world with our existing land? We have to go vertical, multiple stories. That's Desmond Despommier, is one of his key principles of this. There is a lot of analysis going on this, and it's led by this woman named Tara Garnett, not all of it, but much of it, who is at the Food Climate Research Network. And this is associated with Oxford University in London. And boy, they have a lot of papers on this, some really, really good papers. But we're not nearly as dire as many people think. First of all, 30 to 50% of the food we produce is wasted or spoiled. And think of the stuff in our refrigerators that you throw out. You can't eat it. We used all that water, nitrogen, energy to grow it, wasted. We've got to get better at that. And if food cost a lot more, we wouldn't be wasting as much of it. The second thing, animal products have a heavy environmental impact. You look at all the corn and soybeans grown across the nation, those aren't making Wheaties. Those are getting fed to pigs and cows with a big environmental impact. We're in the right society doing horticultural crops because their environmental impact is a fraction of animal agriculture. And here's a couple pictures of this. Carbon footprint of some food products and the source. Remember that cheese a while ago was 8.8, and this one it says 10.8. It's about the same. Carrots, tomatoes, even tomatoes in a greenhouse, tiny. If we can get people to eat more baby greens and less beef, well, we're replacing a big environmental impact with something much smaller. So it's all relative. This is a study out of Michigan State. This is gas emissions, animal agriculture, big-time emitters of methane and nitrous oxide. Look at some of the other things. Tomatoes, apples, rice, teeny footprints for these gas emissions. So again, horticulture is the right product. Let me end with this slide. This is a graph out of our paper on economics of lighting, and that top graph shows the beam angle, so the spread of the LEDs. LEDs are more cost-effective when we need focused photons. When we want to focus on a small area, LEDs are cheaper. But if you can light up a large area with the lights higher up, then the most modern high-pressure sodium lamps are cheaper. So it makes me wonder about the economics of producing a single layer with high pressure sodium lamps like this greenhouse, where the light can spread out and light all the plants, and you're not wasting light because you have a big expanse of light. So our indoor farms are going to have to compete with the best products from another type of controlled environment agriculture, which is just greenhouses with using, in this case, sunlight supplemented with high-pressure sodium light. So I want to go back to Ed's first slide, which, Ed, I thought that was a brilliant slide. the history of agriculture. How efficient is a couple guys with a hoe out there growing food? How efficient is it when we grow our food in a garden? Really efficient. The transport is even less than 250 feet. You're growing it right there in your garden. Minimal impacts. But who wants to be responsible for growing all of their food? We want somebody else to grow it and get it to us. And so the whole history of agriculture is really substituting fossil fuels to make food production more efficient. Big tractors, economy of scale. So indoor cultivation is substituting even more energy to produce even fresher food. But you look at the history of what we've done, we do a lot with substituting fossil fuels to make our lives easier. I probably am the biggest personal indoor grower of food in this room because I had a garage that used to hold an instrument company. They moved out, they got too big. Now that garage is full of electric lights, and my wife and I grow basil and lettuce through the winter and under electric lights in our greenhouse. So I run these numbers and wow, that's a lot of CO2 footprint from growing these in the winter. But I get up in the morning and I don't want to take a winter vacation to the Bahamas. I just want to go out and grow my lettuce in the garage. So I think my next slide shows that. This is the CO2 footprint of air travel. You can look it up, and it's air travel is really expensive. And it's from Utah to the Bahamas, 7,200 kilometers, 700 kilograms for the airlines to transport me to the Bahamas round trip versus 10 to if I'm all under electric lights to grow my lettuce. So I'm happy. I don't fly around as much, so it's there's the trade-off. Thanks.
Need to move on to the next speaker.
Joy.
How does your wife feel about the lettuce from Bahamas?
Don't bring it up. Ed.
Yeah, desalinization has some other side effects. So when I was in the Leeds, the fishermen have to go further and further offshore because the salt that's left.
Because they recycle it back out, yeah.
Solutions, as you pointed out, in many of the things that you presented, have a lot of other impacts. Mm-hmm. So looking at things holistically is difficult.
Yeah, and in fact, life cycle analysis gets complex. You can spend your whole life doing that and adding this in and that in and trying to factor the whole thing. Yeah. Carrie.
Bruce, in phase one of your talk where you're comparing the value proposition for wheat, tomato, lettuce, and how that was going, it seems like for vertical farming, the higher the intrinsic value of the crop to be grown, whether it's a pharmaceutical or marijuana or whatever, it's going to be better and better.
Yeah, yeah. We have a lot of very high value produce, and yeah. My real point there is the original stuff in this. Nobody said this here that we're going to save the world. We're going to grow all of our food under electric lights, and that's not going to happen. I mean, as you know, and we've talked about this, but the high value crops are another matter, especially the ones where. There's a lot of water in them, too.
Thank you, Bruce.
Next.